This is Channel One Over. This is Channel One Over. That afternoon with Suzanne and Susan, Ms. Baum, the Saturday the 31st of January, 70. Saturday the 31st of January, 1970. This is Suzanne and Susan, Suzanne Harrell and Susan Baum, Ms. Baum. That's Saturday the 31st of January, 1970, where we talked. John and Jim both came out. And we had a big afternoon. That was this part of it, and I'll tell you what. Do you know where? Do you know where Hawthorne got his idea of Heston?
Probably out of his own life, if it's
no.
That.
No.
I really don't know.
Now that's shame. That is shame.
It is, huh?
Yeah.
Well, you know, he had those ladies, that type of lady, in all of his work.
No.
He didn't. What about the girl in the marble font? It was so much like Hester.
And I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about where he got
his idea of Hester. I don't know.
All those fine words that he used for. She has that dignity. And that presence.
Yeah, stately.
Now, let me tell you. Those kids at Hawthorne have dignity and presence, too. That the ones on the campus don't have.
Sure. But they're honest.
I don't know what it is. But they may not have it. I'm just saying they do. Now, what I expected of you is to say, yes, I see Hester. And I have seen Hester before. I saw Hester back before, while she was in England, before she came to this country. Where do you think Dimmesdale came from? He's not a product of this country.
Well, didn't Hawthorne say, too, that the women that stood around and watched Hester, that they'd come from, when they'd come from England, that as the generations went on, that the flower became paler and paler?
Rougher, yes. Now, that's partly a scientific view. They thought that up through Hawthorne's time, that as animals went west, they also diminished.
Well, there's a lot of that in Hawthorne's, that as they come from England,
yes,
that they are diminished.
Yes, that's right. That's a scientific view of things, which was, you know, imposed with a culture.
I thought it was just a tradition or something. Yeah,
no, it was. They thought that scientifically. They
really?
Thought from observation, that is, they came home, the horses and over there were big, but when they got over here, they were little.
That's like that idea. I had this in some other course, you know, one of those professors gave it to me, that they thought that as things went west, generally,
yes,
that was called translatio imperii, that as everything went west, it degenerated.
Yes.
And that's why it went like from Rome to Britain,
yes,
to, and now it's our turn, right?
Yes, I thought. But now, let me tell you, Susan, you've got to do better now on your next lesson on Hester.
Right.
Now you and Hester have got to make peace.
Well, I can make peace with Hester, I'm sure, but I can't make peace with the rest of Hawthorne.
No, I'm not talking about the rest of Hawthorne.
I know if you think that if I make peace with Hester, then everything will.
No, I'm not. I'm trying to. You've got to isolate it now. No. I'll talk with you about some of the other Hawthorne things. But now, that Hester, now. Hester, once you see her, she'll be just as clear. In a way, it's like Thoreau doesn't explain to you the public function of a scholar.
Mm-hmm.
When he says that if nothing else, he'll be like Chanticleer and keep people and wake them up. He just assumes that.
Well, now, Hawthorne assumes that his readers have read a little something before they come to him. Mm-hmm. And that's almost kindergarten primary reading.
Mm-hmm.
That is, Hester was known. Why, those great Renaissance ladies. They even impressed Shakespeare. And he speaks of them with great respect, just as Hawthorne does. Now, why he should have to say that is an Emersonian character, I don't know that. But his vision of what that inquiring mind does must have had something to do with it.
I'm listening. That's my only talent, is observation of what's going on.
Well, you also have a point of view in which you observe it.
No, I'm not saying that it was. That wasn't my argument at all. The idea was that it didn't hurt me. Linguistics and anthropology didn't hurt me. It helped me be aware of something that was already in me. And when you're conscious of it, you can exploit it better.
Right? This is slow.
I know. That's always when the bad part comes, you know? See, when you get done, then I'm going to go and write about you and bring it back to you. Right?
No. All I'm going to say is I think you just move a little fast, one grade to the next.
Hmm.
One little child to the next. A little bit fast.
Yeah, well, if I had time to just sit and dwell over it.
It's not a matter of time. It's
you know, I always feel like I'm bothering people, you see. There's not many people that are going to sit down and listen to you go on.
Well, that's the beauty of making a tape. You've got an audience and a writing paper. You don't have to work with those little foolish pieces. You can pick your own. Suzanne, I don't know.
That's the end of this little tape. Channel 1 over, around 85. Channel 1 over, around 85. This is Saturday, the 31st of January, 1970. Channel 1 over, around 85. Saturday, the 31st of January, 1970. Suzanne and Susan, the first time they worked together. Oh, it's just delightful. Although the last part of the tape, I made it heavy. It's heavy on my account. The first part, though, is light enough. And she brought out for me that little manuscript on the Mullins. And that was a milestone. That was a milestone. And this is 90, Channel 1 over, 90. Channel 1 over, around 90, 95. This Sunday afternoon, the 22nd of February, 1970, and I see Ms. Baum just came in that pretty little shiny bug of a car. She's talking to Faye and some of the visitors out there, Marjorie Wing. As soon as she comes in, I'll get her to give me a progress report. Good bit has happened since this last tape. I was embarrassed by the last tape, my part of it, really. This is around 100, Channel 1 over, this Sunday afternoon, 22nd of February, 1970.
Well, now you see, we'll say this over again. Now you see, you're not interested in this accent.
I don't know anything about it, because I just didn't have time to do anything.
Yeah, no, you and, but that's my method. That's where I go. I've been flat for a few days. Just had too much. But I just go along, sort of, you know, loosen up, and something comes coming. I set it down, just rough it out on a piece of paper. And that kind of gets it in my mind. And then maybe a half hour, maybe a half day later, it'll straighten out a little bit, and I'll rough that off. And I could even type it out, have it ready to put in the mail to see that it's not just what I want, and do it all over again. Mm-hmm. But that's, so it's, yeah. I don't know what you'd call that. Now that's what I
meant. It's not bearing down on it. That's the whole thing.
I don't bear down on it.
I mean, it's not.
No. Now that's what I meant when I said to you about your piece.
I know. See, I understand. I just don't. There's no. I understand what you mean, and I see it. But to do it, you have to have time to let things like that set in your mind and go back to it and set and go back to it. You know, and my mind is always being sidetracked by these other things that I have to do. You know, and I get out of the groove, and then I can't get back into it again because I'm on something else.
Yeah.
And I fret about what I'm doing because it's something I don't want to be doing. And see, that makes it all.
Well, I told you just to rough it out once, didn't I?
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
You wouldn't be satisfied with that, but it would have to be
at least it's down on paper.
Yeah.
So you can go back to it and redo it.
That's right. And you can kind of see what you had in mind at this take time. Then you see later how you shift.
Mm-hmm.
But then you don't think.
I know. I would have written it, but then, you know, it's not accessible to other people because my handwriting is so atrocious.
Well, what is it you're doing you don't want to do?
Know what I'm doing that I don't want to do. Going to school. It's true that when it creates an emotional thing. You know, when you're doing something, you're involved in something, you have to make yourself get involved in something that you don't want to do. And I can do it successfully, usually, except recently, the past couple of weeks. I can do it successfully. But then there's all this resentment, you know, because you don't want to be doing that. And so you just sort of shut your mind off for a couple of days, write a paper, and then you can come back. And see, the thing is, you think that you're going to be fresh when you come back to whatever, but you're not.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've been worrying with something that you don't want to do. And so it just sets your whole approach wrong, you know, it puts you in the wrong.
Well, now, what paper was that?
Which one?
That you were talking about.
That I was doing that I didn't want to do?
Yeah.
Any one of them.
Well, the one he gave you, the B-minus on.
Oh, my Hawthorne paper. No,
yeah.
My Hawthorne and my Poe paper.
Yeah.
Well, I just didn't spend enough time with it to do what he wanted. I knew what he wanted me to do, but I just didn't take the time to do it.
What do you want to do?
Well, what he wants you to do is take some symbol, you know, or some image or something. Well, he wants you to do something that's not really true. He wants you to work some idea out that's neat, clever, what he calls insightful. You know, he wants you to get underneath the material. But when he says that, he wants you to do something that's not true. So you end up making something up that fits for the moment, you know, that you can work out, argue logically, and put it down. And usually, you know, I can do this very well. You know,
well,
I've got a lot of practice.
Well, what did you do on that paper?
Well, I did. He gives us these suggestions for topics. Things like a list of things like Poe's the nature of evil in Poe, or Poe's narrators, or something like that. You have to pick one and do sort of an in-depth study. So I did one on Poe, on his view of the nature of evil, and one on Hawthorne, expressionistic setting. And the Hawthorne paper, he thought it was a great idea, but he said it wasn't put together. You know, it was incoherent, which... Well, besides, I don't understand that because I hardly ever write anything that's incoherent. The idea may be lousy, but when I put it together, it's always in order. So, that's it.
Now, what was that in Hawthorne?
On his expressionistic setting. I did a comparison of Hawthorne's garden settings, compared it with medieval dream vision poetry, in the idea that it takes you out into another reality, and then made a case for two different kinds of gardens that are found in medieval poetry. The type of the paradise and the type of, the bower of bliss, and then the combination of the two, like in Chaucer's Parliament of Fowls, where it can go either way. And then I showed how in Hawthorne, and this was, he used similar settings for similar purposes to show the choices in the hero's mind of good and evil. And especially in the Bosom Serpent in Rappaccini's garden.
How does that work out in Rappaccini?
Rappaccini's garden? Well, there's the idea that you have both types here. There's the fountain. this is a central symbol in medieval dream vision poetry. The garden's in there too. There's always a central fountain, either like the well of life, fountain of life, or the opposite, like in the Bower of Bliss, where there are all these nude girls frolicking in the fountain, you know, where it's depravity. And so you have the flowers are, there's something questionable about their nature, you know. You're not sure whether they're good or they're evil. In Beatrice, she's the type of a good person, and also she has this evil effect, you know, where she kills insects with her breath, you know. And there are all kinds of hints. I just picked out everything in the story. There are all kinds of hints that this isn't just a totally evil thing or a totally good thing, but that within the mind of the hero, there's this choice for good or evil, and he fails. He resorts to kind of a materialistic solution when he tries to give her this drug so that it'll clear the evil out of her, and she dies, because she is this combination of good and evil. And he can't accept this, the hero, I forget his name, Giovanni. He can't take the whole thing. And, you know, that was it. But, you know, that's not... I was a little involved with that because it's something that... Medieval dream vision poetry is something that interests me. But, see, now that, to me, is the reason I don't like Hawthorne. I don't want to look for things like that, you know? I know he's... And it distracts me to find those things in Hawthorne.
Now, help me out. Yesterday morning, Miss Daisy came up and visited Mama. We sat here and taped. And she brought with her, they got her, she brought with her one of these little toothpick bowls, pills come in a little jar like that, full of fresh purple violets with a dew on them, or they're moist. And they did smell just like violets ought to do. See, fragrant. That's right down there on Miss Daisy, on the border, right there in front of her house. Now, what Miss Daisy talked about was Arthur dogs. Arthur got four dogs. They either come ahead of him, or with him, or after him. He don't work enough to feed himself. All he does is walk them dogs out on the road and learn how not to make a living. And they dig up his her violence. Now, you see, I don't like symbols. I don't want to work in symbols.
Me neither.
But you see, to me, that just is the occasion that prompts the other talk.
It's just like Thoreau. It's association. It's not symbolic. It's one thing that leads to another. Isn't that Thoreau's whole method? It's that organic. You know, it's like the vine crawling along the ground. One thing leads to another. It's not symbolic. You can do it that way. You can look at it that way if you want to. And that's the way Bigelow asked us to look at Thoreau, you know, that the lake, the pond, as the eye of the world, you know, and the translucent eyeball in Emerson, you know, and all this. But it doesn't hit you over the head in Thoreau, you know. You can look at it the other way. But in Hawthorne, that's what gets me the most, you know. You can't avoid it. You can't avoid attaching symbolic significance to his things because he does it himself. He tells you right there in the story. Thoreau doesn't do anything of the kind, you know. It just grows that way.
Well, that's the reason you see. That's the reason. You see, what you could do is pick up the that fella's point and work on that, and sort of test it to where Hawthorne does face reality, and his art, he handles reality.
Well, I tried that. You know, after we talked about that before, I went back and looked at some of the things.
But what that does, it gets you into experience.
Yeah. Well, see, I can see it, you know, and I know it's there. But it's just too small a part of his writing for me. Except for Hester, and I think you're right about that, you know, that Hester... To there, he really comes, he gets down to it, you know, where he doesn't in his stories,
yeah.
To me.
Well,
You say that, but I really, I guess it's because I have read Hawthorne first with the other view, that I'm distracted.
Well, you
by
you,
that
you,
consistently.
You it seems to me like you have been pointed towards the tales that are altogether symbolic.
Well, I read them. I read most all of them.
Yes, but your attention has been drawn more to the others.
Well.
And then the tales, almost by definition, are that. It's very difficult to get the meaning of them. They're all there. Even Goodman Brown, or any of them. Very difficult.
And those are the best ones. And those are the ones that are most.
Yeah.
That are the most symbolic that way. But even the other ones, I can't get down to it. I can't get past that, you know, the symbol, the way he sticks it out there. Even the things like, say in Marymount, you know, the, what is it, Maypole of Marymount?
Yeah.
Now his description there is more, he gets closer to it there in his description of the Puritans and of the people that are dancing around the Maypole.
Even in that,
but
his
even there,
point distorts
the end, you know, and
sides.
The way he draws them apart and makes a contrast between the two, it ruins it.
Yeah. Well, at least you're wiggling, you're struggling, Susan. I tell you what I did. I kept thinking about what you're saying. See, when I was in graduate school, of course, I was never bright like you are. I wasn't bright. I just
you can't convince me.
Just commonplace.
Well, it's just a matter of being.
But there was no pressure on me ever to make an A.
Yeah.
I made a few. But I saw early in the game that the effort, extra effort, was
not
greater
the,
than
the
his worth.
The gain.
And I didn't have. There was no. You see, I wasn't competing for.
Yeah.
Pride.
See, I don't think I have to. You know, it's not. You don't have to now either. To get an assistantship, to stay in graduate school, you don't have to make it.
No, but to get the big prizes, if you want those.
Yeah.
Ford thing and all like that.
No, you don't. Not to get Ford. To get a fellowship. That's about it.
Yeah.
That's
but,
about it.
But you know what occurred to me was, I've gone through life on just one or two recommendations at one time.
Well, I'm sure it'll be that way, too.
There has been, with me, there has been between me and no job at all, just one or two people who'd vouch for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always, you know, got a living, made a living, and never got far, but that wasn't the reason. I remember one of the students up in that little college where I was the head of the department. You know, for years after I left there, she kept using my name, and I would write about her. I didn't keep up with her. I had no way of doing it. And I would write about her with the same enthusiasm I did when I first knew her. And she coasted along. I mean, she got along on my name. I think she all right, you understand. But I mean, just like that. If you've got two or three people who vouch for you.
Well, I really already do. Because that's how I got my assistantship, was on Dr. Herbert's recommendation and a couple of others. You know, but aside from that, I had a good grade, you know, because it's not something that the school does to you, it's something that I do to myself, really, because I've always been that way, compulsive, and it's something you don't want in your personality, you know, you want to wipe, I do, you know, I don't like it, I wish I wasn't that way, because it gets in the way of things, you know, you can't do what you want to do, because you have to force yourself to, you know, to just squeeze every last drop out of you for these things that don't even matter to you.
I don't think Suzanne is that compulsive.
No, she probably isn't.
You've not seen much of her.
No. She was in a class of mine. But she didn't say anything in that class. I didn't get to know her at all.
She had more time than you had.
Well, I had more time as an undergraduate too. Worse, really, since I came to graduate school. But when I first was taking your course, you know, in that period there, I had a lot more time. I did a lot of things.
That's right.
Well, because my husband wasn't there for one thing, and I didn't have a lot, you know, washing and ironing and dishes and all that too. You know, I did my laundry once a month, you know, instead of once a week.
They haven't reached a point yet where they can
or they can see anything. They haven't done anything. You know, they really, by the time I was there, I'd done about 8 times more than they'd ever done.
Yeah.
And I don't know why it is, but they just haven't. Even the bright ones, you know, and that makes it so much worse. It's the bright ones, you know, that bother you the most.
Yeah.
They haven't done anything.
Let me tell you that.
And that my parents.
No, what was that?
When I was 19.
You talk too fast.
I know I do. It's just.
Slow it up.
It's just the way it is.
When I was about 19.
When I was 19. I don't think I ever told you this, but when I was 19, my.
You're talking too fast.
I'll talk slower. When I was 19, my parents, for any number of reasons, sort of kicked me out of the family. You know, told me that one bad apple spoils a bunch.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And I came up here. Now, don't laugh. Those are my father's very words. My parents threw me out of the house. You know, and they said not to bother to come home. You know, and then. So I came up here, this is, I guess, the middle of my sophomore year, and I didn't have a cent, you know, I didn't have any money. And I came on the bus, my father taking me down to the bus stop. Well, let me tell you how this came about. You know, it was kind of funny. I thought, I had this idea, you know, that if my parents understood what I was like, really, then things would be a lot better at home, because I didn't get along at home for a long time, about 3 or 4 years, you know, I didn't really fit in. So,
how old are you?
23.
23? Well, you're elderly.
I know it. I'm an old lady. So I had this idea, you know, that if I kind of told my father, you know, what I was really like, then things would be better. It was such a foolish thing. Such a ridiculous idea. I should have known, you know, from the beginning. But I had this compulsion, you know, to you know, I felt that all these years he hadn't known me at all. You know, my father and I aren't in the slightest bit close. You know, we'd hardly said more than hello and goodbye the whole time that we'd known each other, you know. So I had this idea, you know, that I could tell him about what I was really like. Well, I'd say, you know, I gave him a few hints, and it was such a shock to him, you know, that he decided that, you know, I really didn't fit in, that it'd be just as well if I'd leave, you know, and didn't ever come back. So, but he didn't want to do it, but he did it because I'd, you know, sort of pushed him into it, you know. So he put me on the bus, you know, without any money or anything, and he said, you know, that when I felt like that I would fit in, you know, I could come back. So I came up to Gainesville, and I didn't have any money, you know, or anything, and I had to drop out of school because he took my tuition back. You know, he'd already paid my tuition, but he sent for it back again, so I had to drop out. And I had to move out of the dorm because I couldn't, you know, if I wasn't in school, I couldn't stay there. And I didn't have any place to live. So I left the dorm, and I went to look for a place to live. First of all, I borrowed $100 from a friend of mine and had to find a job and find a place to live. So I got a room in that place called Roselawn. Have you ever noticed that place? On the corner of where the CI is, on the corner of 17th and University. Big old white house,
yeah,
that has signs,
yeah,
as Roseland,
yeah.
And two older ladies named Smizer that own that property all along there run it.
Yeah.
So I rented a room in there for $32 a month. And it was really a hole, you know, it was one of these rooms that had like pink flowered linoleum with big flowers about 3 feet across, you know, just over the hole. One naked light bulb hanging down in the middle and a few rickety wooden chairs and one of those big iron beds, you know, that you just think. One of these big iron beds, when you sit on it, just sort of sinks down about 3 feet.
I've
you know, just the tired. Well, I didn't know that. I didn't know anything. I mean, I didn't know that. I didn't know anything about this at all until I got into this situation, and it was a whole new experience. It changed my whole life. It was something that. Well, let me go on. I got a room, and I couldn't find a job, and I didn't have any money. So I had to go out, and I was really desperate, and I was really worried because I didn't have any money, and I hate to borrow money, and I'd borrowed $100 from this girl, and that was weighing on my conscience, you know. So I went out, and I found a job working in the med center at night from 6 to 2 in the morning, and I was trying to figure out a way that I could stay in school and do this job, too. So I went part-time that term. I went to school in the afternoon, and I worked all night. And that experience, you know, that whole experience taught me what it was like to be really, first of all, have no money, to be hungry, and to be completely alone. Because that whole time, it's funny how you can become estranged from everybody by something, by, say, an act of rebellion that maybe all your friends pay lip service to. But when it happens, then you're an outcast. So I lived in that room, and I worked at night as a clerk in the medical records department, filing files.
You in the medical field?
Yeah, I was working in the down in the basement with two or three women that were from Gainesville, native. One named Daisy. Some people that were really funny people. I worked there 4 months with Daisy, every night listening to her talk and filing files by this color-coded chart that they had down in the medical center. So you can never make a mistake when you're working with medical files. You can never make a mistake. You can't misplace a file. It's one of those kind of jobs that will drive you out of your mind because you have to be completely exact. That is completely the opposite of my personality. And you have to sign out every time you move a chart from one table to the other. And you have to file, say, 300 or 400 charts in a night. And that's what I did for 4 months. And I lived in this room, and I would walk back and forth between the medical center and the room, and I was completely alone. It was the strangest thing. My family, let's not say this, I wasn't completely alone. My family asked me to write to them every week. Although they'd thrown me out of the house and said for me never to come back, I still had to write to them every week. As when I was first came up here as a freshman, you see, they always told me I had to write to them every week or else I wouldn't get any money. But after they wouldn't give me any more money and they had kicked me out of the family, then I still had to write to them every week. And 1 week, when I didn't write for, I think it was 11 days, my father called the police in Gainesville to come and find out where I was. And I came home from work one night and there was a policeman waiting in Roselawn in the downstairs. And the landlady was so upset, that she thought that one of her tenants, had done something really awful, And so I identified myself, and he said that, of course, I was completely flabbergasted, I didn't know what to think, and the policeman waiting for me. And he said that my father was worried because I hadn't written to him for 11 days. I almost died. that just goes to show you that the ambivalence of the relationship you have with your family is so odd. Even in the time when they've completely rejected you, here they send a policeman after you when you haven't written for 11 days. That was just one of the things that happened. It was incredible, the things that happened to me that 4 months. I had no money. I was trying to save $500. I only made $800 the whole time I was working in the med center. And I wanted to put myself through school. I figured I could do it. I didn't want to take any money from my family, so I could take, well, first of all, they wouldn't give me any. I figured if I worked every other term, I could save enough money to go to school in the terms in between. So I saved money. I ate one meal a day. I cooked at my friend's house and ate like hot dogs and tuna fish every night. And I did this for 4 months. And, I would go to work after I would eat dinner at 6 o'clock. I'd go to work. And I'd be starving, at work I'd be so hungry. I'd try to figure out every way I could to, get any kind of sustenance without spending any money. I'd mooch off all the people, I worked with, like Daisy. She'd always bring, things like 8 donuts to keep her alive during the night. She'd always offer me one. So I always counted on that. But I was always hungry. And I never would let myself spend a cent extra than say I spent $3 a week on food. And I ate one meal a day. And I'd allow myself a quarter luxury during the week. And you never know what it's like to only have a quarter to spend, for luxury until you live like that. I'll never forget what it was like to walk around for a week with a quarter in your pocket trying to decide what you're going to spend that quarter on. I'd think about it for days. That would occupy my mind at work while I was filing files. What am I going to spend my quarter on? Every night I'd entertain spending it on something to eat during the night because I was always so hungry, I work at night. And I'd always spend it on something silly. That was the crazy thing, I'd save it up to the end of the week. and I'd plan, have it all planned out what I was going to spend it on. And then in the spur of the moment, I'd do something crazy, you know, like buy a pack of gum or an ice cream sundae. When you only have a quarter, it's tough deciding what to spend it on. But I saved $500 in 4 months.
Well, now, how far was that from the time I knew you?
Pretty far. Not maybe in time, but
in
experience. It was a long way. It was about, well, let's see, I'd already been married a year. It was about 2 years, I guess, from the time I had that class with you. Well, but it changed my whole life, you know. Eventually, my parents and I were reconciled, you know, and they decided they would pay my tuition and I could earn all the rest. But in that period of time, you know, when I was completely estranged, you know, from my family. I used to wander around at night by myself, you know, just walk around the campus. Because all of a sudden, my whole life was completely turned around. I was really a night person. I couldn't sleep at night at all. I would stay up, even on the weekends. I was so used to staying awake at night that I would be alone at night. And I'd wander around, you know, and during the day I'd sleep. And I completely lost touch of everybody. My whole life was completely changed by that 4 months. Even when my family and I got back together, it was totally different.
Well, Susan, you just don't strike me as a person who'd ever be estranged from anybody.
I was, completely.
Are you sort of redheaded or temperamental?
No, it's not that. It's just that, you see, all my life I'd been hiding my real personality from my family. When they caught a glimpse of it, they were so horrified.
What'd you tell them?
Well, it was a combination of just a lot of things. My family and I had never really gotten along the whole time I was in high school. I just couldn't stand to be around the house. I was so bored. And just the thought that I would grow up, you know, and marry and be like my mother was enough to just scare the life out of me. So I'd spent all my time away from home. And of course my parents were hurt, you know, by the idea that I didn't want to stay at home. So I'd go out. I had one or two friends in high school that were really good friends that were like myself. And we would go out and I'd spend all my time out reading, you know, walking around. Or I never spent any time at home. And my parents couldn't understand why I, you know, didn't want to stay around the house. Well, I couldn't really come out and say, it's because, you know, it's so boring here that there's nothing here that interests me. You know, I have to go out and have some other, and I couldn't say that. But finally I did say that, you see, and it was partly religious, too. You know, my whole upbringing was very conservative and, you know, catechism 8 times a week, you know, and that sort of thing. As soon as I hit college, naturally, I'd been dying to get away for 8 years or something. I just dropped all that, you know. And I guess it was the fact that my father finally realized that it hadn't done any good to make me go to catechism for 12 years, you know, that it was a futile endeavor.
Your father and your mother both?
Well, my mother was a little more, you know, wishy-washy about the whole thing. You know, she's the emotional half of the family. But my father, he had been pushed to the wall, you know, it was a point of principle. He thought that I'd rejected everything that he'd tried to give me when I was young. And if I had, then I didn't belong around the house. And he didn't want to be it, but I forced him into it. You know, it was my own fault. I forced him into it, to making this decision. And instead of backing down in front of me, he had to do it. And all the way, all the way along the line, he wanted me to apologize, you know, to say that what I'd said wasn't really true about myself, but you see it was, you know. And I was so hard-headed at the time, you know, that I said, well, how can I back down from what's my own honest self, you know. Once I'd revealed it, you know, I had to stick with it, and I couldn't back down either, and he couldn't back down either. Well, that's how I got to know Thaxton.
Oh, it is?
I went to him for help because...
The first time? First year?
Yeah. No, not my freshman year, my sophomore year. After my parents threw me out of the house, you know, I figured after a while, you know, that, you know, it might be good to try and get things back together. But I didn't have any idea how to do it because we'd both been forced to this position where we couldn't retreat.
How'd you run into Saxton?
Well, I wanted to find someone to talk to. So I went over to the infirmary for them to recommend someone, a counselor for me to talk to that would, you know, be able to talk to my parents and sort somehow, you know, get this straightened out. So they recommended that, and I called him up, and I went over there. I talked to him I used to go and see him all the time. And he talked to my parents, too. They came up here 2 or 3 times. But you see, it was funny because Thaxton, you know how Thaxton is. He'll just sit and just pass the time of day with you. You know, he'll just, of course, it's, I think it's a lot more subtle than that, but, you know, it has the appearance of that.
Mm-hmm.
And my father would get real irritated with him because he'd say, now let's get down to what we're here for. You know, he wanted to just, and Thaxton, who was trying to just ease him, you know, was trying to maneuver him into seeing something. And he couldn't do it. My father was too, he wanted to just approach it head on, you know, and just tackle the issues. You know, he couldn't relax. And so he and Thaxton didn't get along at all, really.
How did your father get to be so direct?
25 years in the Navy.
Oh, Lord.
See, and a lot of other things. His childhood, you know, he was brought up during the Depression, and he had all kinds of troubles when he was young, and he ran away from home, joined the Navy, and
you know,
all kinds of troubles.
On that program, they had a two-star general who spoke for the Barge Canal. He is everything that closes the mind. He's an engineer. He is a soldier. And he's a first-class bureaucrat.
What about religion?
I don't know about that.
It's true.
All
well, my father's got a lot of that. He's not completely.
All three of them. All three of them.
It does, though.
So you see, the paper he read was wholly without conscience.
Mm-hmm.
Holy. He didn't write it necessarily, but he had no conscience.
Well, that's how my father is to a great extent, except one time, is when he's fishing. That's the only time that he's not that way. That's the one thing he likes to do, I really think that's the one thing he likes to do. If you can go out in a boat with him and talk to him, you have a lot better luck than if you sit down and try and hash over some idea, some ideal, some point.
You know, I was never strong on it, see. But I always said that principle came first. You just had to live up to your principles.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, as I see it now, you see, I'd abandoned principles in favor of a person at a time.
Well, that's what happened to me in the end, too.
Good God Almighty, look how long it took me.
I know. Well, that's what Thaxton was trying to get me to say, too. That, yeah. You know, you can't do that. You know, you have to just bow your head, you know, and just go on like it was before. And that's the way my parents and I have been ever since then. Back on the old footing. That's the only way it'll ever be.
Yeah.
And I was a fool to think that I could ever change it.
Yeah.
You know, by revealing anything of myself.
Oh, well, let me tell you, Faye's little niece, Faye, my name for her, Faye, she came down here and read with me one time. They wanted her to go to this Eastern College, and she'd been to that little school up there and never really studied. She's smart and perceptive, but she was just scared to death. And as soon as she got out of high school, she came down here as fast as she could and read all these things. I remember when she was, I don't know just when it was, but as long, I guess, the latter part of high school, she would just get put out with everybody on principle and things like that. And she never jumped me. I was never there quite enough. But once or twice, she was almost at me. Sincerity was one of the big points.
Oh yeah, well that was my big hang up too, long time ago.
Yes. So maybe
once you get on that idea, you know, once you get that honesty thing, you know, in your mind, it'll ruin your whole life.
But Susan, I thought you'd be like Irving and Rip Van Winkle. You things would all be easy for you.
Oh, well, see, that you don't know me at all. You don't know, you know, that was the by far the hardest part. That's one of the hardest parts of my life. But the result of that stayed with me for a year and a half, with my friends, you know, with my family, even after I got married, you know, with John and I, all kinds of things. You know, that kind of thing just stays with you for a long time.
I don't follow you.
Well, at the time when my parents did this to me.
Yeah.
One of the things that they were so irritated with me about was that I was going with this guy who they thought was just totally just the antithesis of everything that they could want in a person that I would go with. He dropped out of a military academy. He was just the most free, the most alive person that you could imagine. And they couldn't stand him. They'd never met him. But they knew about him through me, and they recognized that in me and him, you know, there were some, a lot of the same things, you know, things that they didn't want to realize that were in me. And at the time, you see, after this happened, then that just fell by the wayside, because the boy felt that he had been responsible for everything that happened to my, to, between me and my family, and it just ruined that whole thing. It ruined relationships with my other friends, because once you're estranged from your family, when you're, say, 19, you know, it's not the same as talking about it. Once it happens, then there's something wrong with you. You know, people look at you and they say, well, if that happened, there must be something wrong, you know. Mm-hmm. And so then I lost, you know, touch with a lot of my friends that way. I gained new friends, but in my whole life was changed because of that. I met different people. Well, and just the whole way that I met, that led up to me meeting John was a result of that. You know, I moved on into this apartment after I got back in school later, and John was living in that same apartment, you know, and that's how I met him. It just changed the whole course of my, everything before that, you know, you might say it had been easy, but it was all on the surface, you know.
Well, now, how did John,
how to meet John?
Where'd
he come in?
Yeah, how did he come in?
Well, he just, you know, was living downstairs from me when I moved into that apartment, and I met him, and you see, one thing about John that's so great, one thing that, that really, see, it's been John that's really got my family and I back together again. Because John and I are alike in so many ways, and yet he has the ability that I don't have to pacify my parents. I'm just too, you know, emotional about it. I get too excited, you know. I get moody and angry, and, you know, and, oh, yeah, well, he's done, you're going to see me around my family one or two times. They're just the kind of people that you just said, that five-star general or whatever it is. My whole family's like that. You talk about getting up, going to Cedar Key and have to take the kitchen sink. My family takes the kitchen sink no matter where they go. It's just completely closed in, clamped down, kill the mind kind of environment that you could ever imagine. See how excited I get about it? Well, I can't, you know, I don't think I'll ever get over that. But John has been the one, you know, that's, he can handle my parents like they're, you know, easy. He's just, it was relaxed with him. Just like I can never be.
Yeah.
So I just let him
do it. Now if it's somebody else's parents, you can do it.
Oh, right. Now I'm his parents. I'm that way with his parents. We have almost exactly the opposite problem. Because John's family is has a lot more problems than even my family. His father's an alcoholic, and they've been bankrupt for years, and they had a lot of money, and his mother has to cook for a living when she graduated from Vassar, you know, and all this. And we go there, and I can get into that situation for a while, although I don't have the patience that John does. But I can help out there. So, you know, we just, two cripples that help each other out in those situations.
Well, I didn't realize that. Well, now, what made you click in that little writing class?
Well, you see, I think this is what it is that basically the outlook that you propound, you know, or talk about is my basic outlook. It's been stifled, you know, and put upon by all this schooling, partly by the schooling and partly just by my own personality. It's too moody, you know, and too broody about things. But that when I'm with friends, you know, and when I'm just talking with friends, that's my personality. It's easy like that, not the way that it is, you know, after I've, you know, when you get nervous and get all the things that school does to you. You know? I think that's why it is, because the minute, you know, I got in there, the minute I heard you talking about that, I recognized what it is about my own view of my own experience. I've always been examining my experience.
Yeah.
I mean, I've always been reconstructing and thinking about it, trying to get different views. And it just happened to hit me, too, at the time. I think one of the biggest factors was, as I just come back from Louisiana, that trip I took.
Yeah.
And that trip, you know, it was another something that was really, something that really meant something to me at that time. John was gone. I went home to visit my father's family. And it was a place where I could really make contact with the people, with the area, with the feeling, with just everything. I just clicked in with that culture, and I enjoyed it so much. And when I came back up here and came into that class, there was the perfect opportunity to do what I wanted to do.
And you had Ms. Rollins to respond to you.
Yeah.
It could have been Ms. Rollins that did it, not me.
No, it wasn't. I know, because I don't think it was, because that didn't come to me until afterwards. It was my involvement with the experience, really, I think. I was so still involved with it. You know, it was on my mind constantly. And I didn't read all of Cross Creek until after that. I wrote the paper the first day of class. And then later, I read the whole Cross Creek after you read that part in class. You know, we had one assignment, one little short assignment. I just sat down, I got so involved, and I read the whole thing. But I don't think that was it, no. It was the fact that it touched something that was really me.
Yeah.
I think.
There's a great premium in the way I do that on being articulate. And you must have been articulate all your born days.
With a few people.
But I mean with yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's always in my mind.
And there you see it.
It's not very often that it comes out,
yeah,
though.
Yeah.
Only with a few people.
And you had the benefit of my experience of 7 years of how to handle it in a manuscript.
Now, see, I'd never tried to write anything like that.
Yeah.
I'd experimented around with plenty of writing poetry. That's what I always wanted to do.
Is that right?
I think you're wrong. I don't think it'll ruin you, not the way I try it. Because the way I try it, it's not the symbolic twisting, you know, clamping down on the experience and distorting it. Just letting it come out. But that was the first time I'd ever tried to do it in prose. It's the first thing I've ever written.
You never showed me any poetry.
Yeah, well, most of it I've thrown away.
Oh, no, yeah.
Or else I gave it away. Most of it I wrote for someone else.
Well, you've got to keep a copy in your file.
I know it, but see, my feelings always change, and then I want to throw it out.
No.
I know it, but that's the way I've always done it, though. I only have a few things, you know, that I've written. Some other people I know have things that I've written. Every once in a while, I think I'm going to go and get it back, you know, so I can see what I was thinking back then.
Yeah.
I know someone that has a lot of poetry that I've written.
You ought to get new, but I shouldn't keep it. I mean, really, you ought to.
I know it. I know I should.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's always been something about it, though, that I always want to go back and throw it out later.
Just for your own file.
I know.
Where you've
been looking. I've been so sorry a lot of times that I've done it, thrown it out or given it away.
Well, I didn't realize, what a cracker box, cracker box I've been dealing with.
You just don't know what a mess I am.
Yeah.
It's true.
If I'd known it, I'd shy it off.
Probably. I wouldn't have blamed you either.
Yeah.
Probably a lot of people that have known me have wished they'd done the same thing.
And this makes you impatient with Hawthorne?
What does?
What you're just saying, all that background.
Well, to some extent, because it just doesn't strike me as true. It just doesn't have enough, he doesn't have his feet enough on the ground to me.
Now, you haven't read Poe with me.
I know. I read a lot of Poe, though.
But you haven't
talked
read.
Talk to me about it.
You haven't read my Poe.
I know. Well, I thought about it, though, when I was reading A. Gordon Pym.
I've not handled A. Gordon Pym. I don't know.
There are a lot of things in there. Now, see, I can't, tales somehow to me, I'm reading Melville's Tales right now. And I'm having the same problem
I
had with Hawthorne's Tales,
yeah,
with Poe's Tales.
Yeah.
The construction that you need to get a tale.
Yeah. I've not read much of Hawthorne, much of Melville. The ones I have, I'd settle for more day. You have
to. I would too.
You know, you have to read all that and
just so you
plow
can have
through it.
Now. That's what I'm doing.
You see, that throws light on the other, but now, you know.
You know, 600 level student, you know, that had, that was prepared. Now, see, that would be more interesting to me than like the students you have.
Have mental muscle.
Yeah, because then they would be able to just go into it a little bit more. But these students that you have are just sort of just getting their feet wet. Yeah. And they're not really.
Speaking of that song, we gotta have time to study some of these things.
I don't know how I'm gonna have any time now. I work or I starve. I can't go to school this summer because I can't get an assistantship, and I'm just as glad, you know. I can't get any money. I've already tried.
Mm-hmm.
John has to go to school.
Yeah.
Probably, or else we're gonna be here forever if he doesn't just go ahead. Mm-hmm. That means I have to work. John can't get an assistantship in the summer. So that means the only income we're gonna have is gonna be me. And whatever I can make in the summer is going to be nothing, which means we're going to be really hard up the whole summer. And the end of the summer, we're not going to have any money to pay our tuition. We're going to have to get in hock like we are now. So see, it's just a vicious circle. I can't take off, you know. I can't.
I wish you could listen to some of these tapes.
Well, I'd love to if I had time. But, you know, if I had
I mean, make it your principal business.
Yeah, well, if I had an independent income... That'd be good. See, I'm completely tied down by these finances. Because we're just on the edge, you know, all the time. It's one little slip up, you know, and we don't have any money.
Yeah. How much money you need?
Who knows? Last summer I was really lucky and I got a great job. Mrs. Steen, the personnel director at the library, who's just been real nice to me because I've worked there before, you know, she got me a job. Paying about twice as much money as I would have made normally. I was going to work for this as a clerk one for $265 a month, but then she got me another job by taking money out of some other fund. It was kind of a shady deal, you know, but I didn't care because she was paying me $465 a month, which is great for a summer job. Now she says that she might be able to get me a job again this summer, but not at that pay, you know, which means I'll be back working as a clerk one or something like that. And see, that just barely pays our bills. We can't, you know, save up money for tuition for the next term if we're only getting $265 a month. So I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm still worrying about that. I've got to go find a job. Thurston thinks he might know a place where we can stay without for free, you know. Where I think we have to move out of our place in June because it's his summer house. He only rents it from September to June. So we don't know where we're going to live or anything either. We want to find a cheap place to live, but, you know, we don't, you know, we have to start looking for a house. And I love it out there. I could stay out there for the rest of my life, you know. But the heat has cost us a fortune this winter. We've had to pay $250.
Why?
$50 a month.
See, that's
it's ridiculous. Yeah. And see, we don't have any money, and that's killing us, you know. And our gas going in and out, it's bad, but, you know, that's not the worst. It's the heat. So I don't think we're going to be able to live there next year.
You just make one trip a day, don't you?
Well, John, a lot of times has to go back to the library at night, unless we eat in town. He's been doing that for about a week now, every night, because he's got this 80-page paper or something he's got to do. He's got to go to the library all the time for his legal research. He's not going to have that next quarter, though, thank goodness.
Well?
See, you know, all these complications. You can see why I don't have any time, you know. Spend all my time either doing the laundry, washing the dishes, in the car, going back and forth. Get me in my class where I teach
that,
my freshmen.
That little tape of Willie's now on the baptismal, I didn't have time, no. On the baptismal tank. He's patient with all that fine experience. And he doesn't point it. He just, I don't know exactly what he does, but he lives with his experience. Just let it go at that. Now you see, back in the when you were first writing, your points were so clear. I didn't know whether you'd ever turn loose that high tension wire, so I could see the experience, and that's what was so pleasing about the little paper on the Mullins. But that's so easy, you see, and relaxed. And Alton read it, and he said he thoroughly enjoyed it. You have control, but it's the experience is there.
You want to know what makes attention, though? It's when you're talking about something or you're writing something, and your mind is divided into two different tracks. When I wrote that, you know, I'm sitting down alone in my house, no one else around, and I could just... My whole thought was on that thing. The subject just came out. But when you're... Except when I'm reading, you know, in a class, say I'm reading to my class when I'm teaching. I love to read. You like to read, too, because when you read in class, your manner is totally different when you talk. And I like to read like that, too. It's because you can put your whole thought on that thing and just put your everything into it.
Yeah.
But when you're talking or when you're writing for someone else, and you know it's going to be for someone else, your mind is divided. You're talking about your subject, and yet you have this other part of you that's looking at it and saying, I wonder if I'm saying that right, or how is this going to come out after it's over, or it's that division of your mind that makes it come out tense and not smooth. You don't just let it go.
Well, now, I learned a good bit about Ishmael from Barbara. Barbara had lived with horses, and she said the one thing you can't do with horses is to hurry them. They have the whole day ahead of them. And she's had to live around horses. She thinks like that and acts like that. Her movements are like that. I think Ishmael has that quality. I don't think it's a matter of slowing down or being hurried. I think it's just, of course, with him, his way of life. It was a way of life in his time.
You don't have your mind on two or three different things.
No, yes, they did too. But they also had this view. And that's what he puts in the little sketch of the Canadian woodchopper. And of that little farmer miner that I read you one day from his mm-hmm. And that's the innkeeper with his plane softening that thing. You see what it is?
I see, it's slowing down.
No. It's the view of life.
Yeah, but the view of life is slowing down.
No.
It's when they have to, when he takes time to look at the innkeeper planing the wood and to look at it, first thought. And you can't do that if you've got your mind on something else and you're running along, not trying to keep all kinds of other thoughts and tension and everything all in your mind at once.